Today, David Cameron is back, but what's his political legacy? And who's going on the global climate strike? Patrick Winter, you've been covering Westminster for The Guardian and Observer for more than three decades. You were political editor for 10 years. Do you remember the first time you heard the name David Cameron?
The first time I heard of him was when he'd become an MP and he was advising Michael Howard on how to deal with Prime Minister's questions. And I remember having lunch with him, knowing he was an up-and-coming MP. And the bit that I remember most about it was his sense of that politics was slightly a game. He kept on saying it's really all about what you can get away with.
What you could get away with? What does that mean?
Well, the Prime Minister's questions, for instance, if you can ask a question which is totally unfair or totally distorts what the your opponent has been saying, it doesn't matter as long as you get a quick hit on the nightly news with that.
If politics was a game for David Cameron, he definitely did not win. Here was an MP who set out to be a moderniser, to rebrand his Conservative Party as greener, more compassionate and socially liberal. But as he re-emerges this week to promote his new book, it's clear that his premiership will be remembered for two era-defining changes to British society: austerity and Brexit. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, where did it all go wrong for David Cameron? Patrick, when we started thinking about this episode, we wanted to know what David Cameron was thinking at the very start of his political career. And we were pretty surprised to find that he had documented his thoughts in his very own Guardian blog, starting when he was a candidate for MP. It's been very interesting to read it back. I mean, you talk about him seeing politics as a game. In one blog, he suggested dirty tactics for PMQs. In others, he tries to present himself as a bit of a laugh. There's one, I'm not kidding, about erectile dysfunction, in which he talks about stiffening the resolve of government. I'll let you look that one up. And in another, he compares the Tories to the Skoda, making the point that even terrible brands can be revived. And week on week, it feels as if he does keep coming back to that theme of branding. Was his driving force back then all about modernising the Conservative Party?
Well, obviously he came from PR, in a sense, from television. And I think he did listen a lot to pollsters. He did the whole Tory party. When you're in opposition, any party is endlessly reading the runes about how people view the party, what's wrong with it. What was remarkable about his early speeches and his attempt to become leader were they were all about the Conservative Party itself. They were much less about policy.
There is no magic wand. There's no one thing that we can do to show that this party thinks Britain's best days are ahead. It is a change right across the board. This party has got to look and feel and talk and sound like a completely different organisation.
Obviously, he talked about a limited state, low tax, about responsibility, but he managed to frame those very traditional Tory themes in a kind of modernised context. And very good at thinking of the right aphorism, such as let's roll back the state, but not roll back society. Very clever at thinking modern ways of trying to attract people to what were quite traditional Tory values.
And use modern technologies, because it wasn't just his Guardian blog. He later had something called Web Cameron that I would encourage listeners to Google.
Right, Web Cameron, come here. Are you working? Is it on?
Yep.
Right, this is Web down on the farm. Web Cameron. Meet my friends. Talking about local food, which I think is a really important issue. This is a working farm that also has a very good farm shop, which I hope you'll
see. When did he start to really catch your attention?
Well, I think I was absolutely bowled over. I remember it was in September 2005. David Davis and David Cameron had got through to the last round of the Tory leadership.
In Europe,
we'll take back powers of self-government from Brussels to the British Parliament. Because the issue of Europe...
David Davis had had a very traditional launch, wooden. The speech was very, very what one had heard from the Tory party for many, many years. Cameron held his event.
Some people say that we should just move to the right. I say that would be wrong.
In a very airy room.
I don't want this party to become a fringe party that would never challenge for government again.
Moved around the stage.
I don't want that, do you?
And he spoke without notes.
Real change isn't just about policies or presentation or organisation or even, dare I say it, having a young, vigorous, energetic leader. Although, come to think of it, it's not such a bad idea.
He was absolutely captivating, and you realised that this man was going to win.
You've talked about Cameron's quick rise to the leadership and those early ideas that he shared at the time. If he were to cast his mind forward at that moment, what do you think he would have judged as a successful political career for him?
Well, success was obviously achieving power. He believed it was possible to pull a coalition together, which married a kind of form of social liberalism with a kind of economic dryness. There was a lot of little signals he kept on trying to send out as an opposition politician, such as going to work on a bicycle, being photographed with huskies in the Arctic.
And finally, you know what your critics say about you, that you you sound good, you do good things like this. It looks good, there's no doubting that, you know, going along with some dogs on a sled. But actually, is there more behind it than just the good
photo? There's real, you know, if you look at the speech, there's real content there. I'm saying, let's have...
Putting little windmills on his home, trying to present a modernised image of the Tory party.
What do you mean, putting little windmills on his home? I don't remember that.
I think he had a kind of minor sort of attempt at sort of solar wind power in his home to try and generate...
How big's his home? You can put a windmill in it.
I think you can have quite small windmills.
So Cameron's ambition was to modernise the Tory party, to care about the environment, be socially liberal and so on. But it didn't pan out like that, did it?
No, in the end, I think his premiership is defined by two events. One is the financial crash in 2008, and the other is the gathering schism in his own party about Europe and how he chose to respond to that.
Let's start with the response to the financial crash in 2008. What did he do?
Well, in 2007, to allay voters' fears about public spending cuts under the Tories, he had promised to match Labour spending right up to 2010-11, and he made a big pitch on that point. However, a year later, once the financial crash had hit, and he began to feel that the public spending forecasts of Gordon Brown were optimistic to the point of being ridiculous, he decided to drop that pledge. And from there on, you start to see the development of the argument about how the UK had to respond to the crash and the UK deficit.
Do you think he thought it was economically necessary? Or do you think he and George Osborne saw this as an opportunity, politically speaking, that there had been a financial crash? They could quite simply, even though it didn't always make economic sense, pin the blame on Labour and persuade the country that you needed now to turn to the Tories to fix the problem.
Yeah, I think Gordon Brown deserves a lot of credit for how he helped to rescue the world almost from the crash and the role he played in that. But Cameron was very adroit at arguing that the specific British problems had been caused by overspending by the Blair-Brown government.
Mr. Deputy Speaker, today everyone can see what an utter mess this Labour government and this Labour Prime Minister have made of the British economy.
You have this phrase, they didn't fix the roof while the sun was shining.
There is not one country with a bigger budget deficit in any major economy. Why is that the case? Because they didn't fix the roof when the sun was shining.
A very effective phrase, kind of homely phrase, which they were very good at using to explain the need for austerity. But whether he himself really believed it, believed the scale that the deficit did require the level of spending cuts, I think is questionable. I think he saw it as a device to pin Brown into a corner.
Yeah, it felt a bit at the time like Cameron the PR man as well. I mean, I remember in the lobby where the political journalists sit, Tory advisers literally coming around with a credit card to try and make the analogy of, you know, if you've got a credit card, you've got to pay off your debt, which I'm not sure completely scales up to a national question, but there you go. And it's worth laying out the scale of the cuts. Worst hit councils, 60% cuts. I mean, that's social care, child protection, bin collections, libraries, public investment that we'd seen under Blair and Brown on hospitals and school buildings came to a virtual standstill. And then there was massive welfare reform with 25% off the total budget, hitting the poor, hitting the most disabled. I mean, you wrote a lot about that at the time. And along with that, many would argue some pretty divisive language.
For too long, immigration has been too high. The largest influx of people that Britain has ever had. And so real integration takes time too. That's why when there have been significant numbers of new people arriving in neighbourhoods, perhaps not able to speak the same language as those living there, on occasions not really wanting or even being willing to integrate, that has created a kind of discomfort and a disjointedness in some neighbourhoods.
They were trying to kind of depict people as benefit scroungers. They were kind of going quite hard against asylum seekers. They did make people more hostile about immigration.
Migrants have been filling gaps in the labour market left wide open by a welfare system that for years has paid British people not to work. That is where the blame lies. So I see it like this. Immigration and welfare reform are two sides of the same coin.
I mean, it was miles from the modernising image that Cameron had wanted to depict pre-2008. Was he worried about it?
I don't think he was. And in fact, I mean, in the interviews he's given, the only point he's made in response to the criticism about the degree of austerity is to say that they should have hit harder earlier and that maybe it shouldn't have been as extended.
I've never wavered in the belief that it was necessary to make difficult decisions.
Cut more.
I think what I say in the book is, look, first of all, we inherited a forecast to be 11% budget deficit, the biggest in the world.
No, I
thought the country
that,
was at huge risk. Yep, there is a case for saying that some of the changes we had to make in year two, in year three, in year four, it might have been better if we did a little bit more a bit earlier when you have that sort of window of permission from the public.
And it felt as if austerity totally dominated that period. But were there other policies that he was achieving in the meantime that perhaps did fit with the brand that he had started out with?
For instance, on same-sex marriage, he was quite openly willing to confront the Conservative Party conference on the issue and say there is no harm someone loving somebody of the same sex in the same way as you're loving someone of a different sex. And to be able to say that to a Conservative Party conference and get an applause line is quite an achievement.
Conservatives believe in the ties that bind us, that society is stronger when we make vows to each other and we support each other. So I don't support gay marriage in spite of being a Conservative. I support gay marriage because I am a Conservative.
So there are aspects of what he's doing in tune with the kind of person he wanted to be in 2007 and 8. But whether there's enough follow-through on policy, and obviously the big example of that is the Big Society, which was this rather tenuous, if not vacuous, concept of trying to have more community voluntary activity. Though it had been a huge theme outside government, when he brought it into Whitehall, it sort of seemed to disintegrate in the hands of civil servants and ministers and ended up with sort of a £5 million empowerment fund or something of that kind.
Not going to make up for the tens of billions of cuts to local services.
No. And he gradually dropped it as an idea. I mean, it basically disappeared. And given it was one of your foundational principles, that is kind of telling.
Let's talk about the second crisis that you highlighted, the question of Europe.
Yeah.
David Cameron still says that there had to be an EU referendum. Is that right?
Well, I think that's going to be the great argument about his legacy, was whether there was an absolute necessity to do this. And his broad position is, though he regrets the consequences of the referendum, he still thinks it was the right thing to do, and if it wasn't done then, it was going to have to be done later.
Well, I'm deeply sorry about all that's happened. There isn't a day that goes by when I don't think about all the decisions I made and all that has followed. But when I go back to that decision, that Britain's position needed to be sorted and we needed a renegotiation and a referendum, I believe then that was the right approach.
I think he's wrong in that, straightforwardly. And I think he got captivated by his ability to win referenda. He'd felt he'd won this referendum on electoral reform convincingly. He won the Scottish referendum and he thought he was going to get lucky three times. And indeed, he told European leaders at the last council summit before the referendum that he's a winner and he was going to be victorious.
But he didn't just call this referendum because he thought he could win it, even though clearly he was very confident. He called it because he was having defeat after defeat in Parliament at the hands of dozens of Eurosceptic Tory MPs. He was losing votes to UKIP. I mean, UKIP topped the polls in 2014. He had MPs who later defected from his party, like Mark Reckless and Douglas Carswell, who were plotting to try and disrupt things when Britain had to lift transitional controls on immigrants from Romania and Bulgaria. I mean, could Cameron really have avoided a referendum in that situation?
If you keep feeding the Eurosceptic beast red meat, it will come back and ask for more, because it won't go and slouch off into the shade and lick its lips. It regards whatever red meat it's given as a kind of hors d'oeuvre before it gets to the main course. And the main course is always leaving the European Union. And that's just a way of how you handle this kind of Euroscepticism. In the end, I think he always appeased it and fed it in the process. And when he went to Europe, he would have a row about Juncker. He'd have a row about using the veto. He'd make demands about free movement. And he was constantly feeding this idea that Europe was a roadblock to success in the UK. And you can't turn around public opinion in a referendum campaign when you've allowed something to become so embedded in the public psyche. I mean, he did face big rebellions in his own party, but he just, I think, had to face it off. And he was advised as much by Nick Clegg, by Osborne, and by Gove. So you can't get three people closer to him who told him and warned him of the consequences and the risks involved.
How should we judge the way that Cameron handled the campaign?
Well, I think some of his explanations of what went wrong with the campaign that have come from his book are quite valid. One is that he raised expectations too high about what the negotiations would achieve. And I think he should have been more aggressive about the kind of Islamophobic campaigning that was conducted by the Leave campaign, because he's been quite clear now in his book to say that there was Islamophobia in the campaign.
If we're prepared to accept, or if Germany and Sweden are prepared to accept unlimited numbers of young males from countries and cultures where women are at best second-class citizens.
And the hidden messaging about Turkey joining the European Union was, you know, if you vote Remain, you'll have a Muslim next door. And he said said as much in terms, but he didn't say that kind of thing in the campaign. And he stuck to this rather dry message about economic threat of leaving the European Union and never really went off it.
When we're hearing from David Cameron this week, having not heard from him at all really since he resigned, as you've said, he doesn't seem too disturbed by the first major crisis, if you like, his response to the financial crash and austerity. But he clearly does have regrets over what happened in terms of the EU. Although when you're describing it, I almost feel like those regrets are still more about party and political differences than about the country.
Well, I think it's not dissimilar in an odd way about to Tony Blair in Iraq and the nature of the apology that has been given, although they're obviously incredibly different issues in scale and global scope, but that What he's saying, in essence, is that he was not wrong to take the decision to hold the referendum, but he regrets the consequences. In the same way, Tony Blair says he was not wrong to go to war in Iraq, but he regrets the consequences. And it's a way of not quite owning the responsibility.
Had David Cameron won the EU referendum, had it been Remain, he had a plan within days to unveil what he called the Life Chances Strategy. This was going to be the beginning of his kind of legacy building period. I mean, interestingly, I've spoken to the author of that paper and tried to persuade him to leak it to me many a time, although I don't know how interested people are in it now. It just makes me wonder if the reason that David Cameron regrets Europe and not austerity is because Europe finished his career and prevented him from laying down a legacy that may have been more in line with that David Cameron you first met years ago before he even became Tory leader.
Yeah, I think it's a great thought experiment, which probably is not done enough, as to what would David Cameron have done if he'd remained Prime Minister, because I think he'd probably be standing down around now. So we'd have had three more years of his leadership. And I think issues such as social mobility would have come to the fore, whether he would have publicly declared the era of austerity is over, whether he would have said, I've got to accept why a very large minority of people feel so antipathetic towards Europe. What does it mean? Is the relationship between austerity and people's anger about Westminster and Whitehall? And I just think it would have been fascinating to see how he would have developed. And then I think at the G7 or at the G20, he would have been a very significant figure, one of the most experienced politicians, and who had pulled off a huge trick in beating Eurosceptics back. He would have been seen as a bulwark against populism.
So that's your sliding doors moment, Patrick. Had the referendum gone the other way, 52 remain, 48 leave, there's your hypothetical Prime Minister Cameron heading off to the G7 instead of Boris Johnson this year. Instead, he's been locked away in his shepherd's hut, in his garden, writing his book that we're now hearing about. And instead, his premiership has been defined not by life chances and social mobility, but by austerity and Europe. And I do wonder if we should actually think of it as part of a causal chain. I mean, you could argue that Crisis One led in part to Crisis Two. Austerity and the rhetoric of division that he and Osborne fostered were arguably significant drivers for the result of the referendum.
I do think they are. I think the two great episodes of his premiership are absolutely linked. I think that austerity was not the sole cause of the referendum outcome, but it was extremely large component of it. There was a sense of alienation from Whitehall and anger about what had happened to living standards, and anger about public services, health, schools. And at the same time, there was an English nationalism, north and south, including in prosperous parts of the UK, anger about immigration, which in a term was maybe reflected some of the kind of welfare rhetoric of the Conservative Party.
And arguably, you could take that link a step further. You know, one of Cameron's wins in his eyes would clearly be the Scottish referendum in 2014, protecting the unity of the UK. He thought that had settled the question for a generation. But Brexit now may well reopen that question. And amid that, there's even talk about the increasing likelihood of a united Ireland. I mean, is it possible that there's almost a domino effect here in which Cameron doesn't just oversee us leaving the EU, but potentially is responsible in some ways for the breakup of the union?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I remember how concerned at one point he was that he was going to lose the Scottish referendum and that he was going to be responsible for the breakup of the union. And I think he privately thought that was going to be a resigning issue as well. And I think that those two threats to the union in Northern Ireland and the union with Scotland are real, but we don't know how this is going to play out.
All of which explains David Cameron's sleepless nights that he outlined this week in interviews since his premiership ended. But if we think back to the kind of fresh-faced David Cameron, who you met all those years ago, who was trying to woo The Guardian. His kind of driving force back then was to modernise the Conservative Party. He wanted to change it. He wanted to fix a broken brand. And here we are in 2019. We've got the most right-wing cabinet that there's been in decades. 21 Tories on the more liberal wing of the party. Cameron's wing, arguably, have been expelled. All of which, I might be being a bit unfair here, but all of which you can trace back to decisions made by David Cameron. So is his legacy in the end that he's failed on that initial driving ambition?
You can discuss till historians do this for their profession is the role of the individual history, how much they're shaped by events, buffeted by events, and how much they can turn shape those events. And certainly the financial crash is not his responsibility. The way he responded to it is, and the degree of Euroscepticism, nationalism inside the English Conservative Party predates him. But how he dealt with it is his responsibility. I think he could have behaved differently on both issues. And that is ultimately his legacy. The way he handled these two issues, as he himself admits, was a failure. I don't know how much he's actually absorbed that failure. There is a deep, deep personal responsibility. I don't think he's fully absorbed it yet.
Patrick, as ever, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was The Guardian's diplomatic editor, Patrick Winter, talking about David Cameron, who, in case you missed it, has published his memoir, For the Record. Coming up, could today's climate strike be a catalyst for change? Now, Guardian columnist George Monbiot recently made a film with Swedish activist Greta Thunberg on the need to protect, restore and use nature to tackle the climate crisis. Today, inspired by her actions, millions of climate strikers are expected to take to the streets. George will be there too. He explains why this is so critical.
This, I think, is the moment at which the world wakes up. Finally, we are seeing protests commensurate with the scale of the existential crisis that we face. And I feel I've been waiting for this for the whole 34 years in which I've been a journalist and activist, trying to raise awareness on these issues, not getting all that far. It sort of feels to me as if all this time I've known what to say and what to write, but I haven't really known what to do. And finally, we have a movement of people who know exactly what to do. And I'm very happy to be a follower of that movement. I think it's crucial that adults show solidarity with Greta Thunberg and the many other young people who have provided such an inspiration and shown such powerful leadership and are really beginning to change the global conversation about climate breakdown and environmental breakdown. But we can't just leave it to them. We can't say to ourselves, oh, the young people have got it covered. We need as many people of all ages to move into this space, to stand in solidarity with the young people, to be led by the young people. I suspect that people are going to look back to the climate strikes today as the moment at which things began to change. Unless we see systemic change, then it's very hard to see how we're going to pull ourselves out of the death spiral that we're currently in. The economy is structured in such a way that it's almost destined to destroy our life support systems, to destroy our habitable planet. What we now know is that we've left things so late that it's not enough just to cut our greenhouse gas emissions. In order to prevent more than 1.5 degrees of warming, even 2 degrees of global heating, we have to draw down greenhouse gases that we've already released and start locking them away. And by far the most effective and the cheapest way of doing that is to allow nature to recover. And of course, not only does that help prevent climate breakdown, it helps prevent ecological breakdown as well. In fact, it could stop the sixth great extinction if we do it on a big enough scale. I recognise, of course, that not everybody can come to the strikes. A lot of people are really constrained by their working environment. But if you possibly can, I think you're going to be at an historical event that you really wouldn't want to miss.
That was George Monbiot. I hope as many of you as possible will be out there with him. Do watch the brilliant film he made with Greta at theguardian.com. That's it for today. My thanks to Patrick Winter and George Monbiot. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. I hope you have a lovely weekend. We'll be back on Monday.